Charles, can I start by giving a little bit of your family background?
Well, I'm 47 years old. I was born in Nebraska. I'm a middle-class family. My father was a dentist. And I'm the youngest child. I have had a brother much older than I was, 26 years old, years older than I am, who on the death of my father became my guardian. So I was raised my dad died when I was 5, and I was raised by relatives. Eventually, at the age of 13 or 14, I guess it was, I ended up with my older brother as my guardian, and lived with him until I entered the Marine Corps.
What made you decide to pick the Marine Corps?
Well, I went in the Marine Corps during the war in 1943. My original thought had been to join the Navy, but my brother had refused to sign a minority form. You know, minority enlistments require the permission of your parents, and he refused to do that. This was in 1942 when I went. So in 1943, when I was 18 and of draft age, I went down to register for the draft and volunteered for the Marine Corps at the same time. They were the only service open. Couldn't get in the Coast Guard, couldn't get in the Navy, so I went to the Marine Corps.
Well, why did your brother, as your legal guardian, refuse to sign?
Well, he was looking out for me. I can appreciate his position. I was only 17 years old and just a kid to him. And of course, I was just
a kid. You know,
a kid. And he simply, although the war was on, it was a patriotic thing to do, to go into the service, of course. Still, he wanted to protect me from as long as he could.
Can you tell me what years you were in Vietnam?
I went there in July of 69 and came back in August of 70.
Where were you stationed?
At Monkey Mountain, which is in Da Nang in the northern sector.
What was your rank while you were in Vietnam?
I was a Master Gunnery Sergeant.
Can you tell me a little bit about your military duties while you were there?
Well, I was a communicator. And being a senior enlisted man, I was in a Marine Air Control Squadron, which is a unit that has to do with primarily with air traffic control. And as the senior communicator in the organization, I was the operations chief, and that has to do primarily with communications. At one time, our sergeant major was evacuated for health problems, not as a casualty, and I was the acting sergeant major for a short period of time. That was simply because I was a senior enlisted man, other than sergeant major.
Can you tell me why you went to Vietnam?
Well, of course, as a professional military man, it was inevitable that eventually I would get a tour of duty there. I requested the tour. I'd been stuck here at Marine Corps Recruit Depot teaching in Communication Electronic Schools Battalion for a considerable period of time, and I simply wanted to get over there. I didn't want to get left out.
What was your training like by the Marine Corps before you went over? Was there any preparation or introduction to Vietnam?
In what sense?
Well, your field of electronics, or in, say, knowing a little bit about Vietnam.
You mean the political situation, language, that kind of business? Yes. I received, as far as technical training, that there was nothing peculiar to Vietnam about the equipment or about the exercise of my particular expertise in communications. Nothing new there. We were given a 3-day indoctrination. This, on the West Coast, this was taken care of at Camp Pendleton. And the indoctrination consisted primarily of the war situation, of the military's view of the political situation. We were given some rudimentary introduction to the language, common terms, and given the normal warnings that are given to any military man going into a foreign situation like this about our conduct.
Can you give me an example of some of those warnings?
Well, it had to do primarily with our relationship with Vietnamese civilians and our counterparts in the military. And when I say a standard warning, it's really kind of common sense stuff, that you are a guest, a visitor in the country. You're not going there as a conqueror. A man in the military, especially an American soldier in foreign countries, you know, we've had considerable success, World War II, Korea, First World War. American military men tend to think of themselves as, they're very self-centered in their approach toward foreign nationals. In my own experience, you know, I was involved in the Japanese occupation. I was also in China after the war. And where you are the power, the authority, you tend to get a rather exaggerated sense of your own importance. And that's, you know, the indoctrination was pointed along those lines, that we were there as guests, we were there as military, to militarily assist the Vietnamese.
Well, since you got a little bit of the political background of the Vietnam War, what were your views before you went over?
Oh, I supported the war 100%. I thought that we had, of course, I took a professional view, somewhat similar to what Chesty Puller, you know, we heard in that record, that, or that tape that Dr. Mellon did the other day. I thought that was kind of funny, because I'd heard Chesty Puller use this term. You know, don't knock it, it's the only war we have. And that's a very professional viewpoint. And I supported the war. I hadn't really given any deep thought to the political situation. The unpopularity of the war had really, you know, kind of escaped me.
And it hadn't really begun to get into a full force by then either.
Well, 69, there was a lot of agitation. 69, if my memory is correct, let me see now, 69 or 70, I think. While I was in Vietnam, the Kent State business took place, and there was a tremendous amount of agitation on the campuses. So I was aware of all the political dissent, but I didn't lend any credence to it.
Well, what about your view of the Vietnam War after you'd been there for, say, 6 months? Did it change?
Very little.
Very little. You still stayed on the side of for the war.
Well, I certainly had no doubts whatsoever about the correctness of the Marine Corps' involvement in that war. You know, that was a determination, a political determination that had been made by the Commander-in-Chief, by the Commandant of the Marine Corps, by the Chief of Naval Operations. I certainly wouldn't question that. The things that disturbed me about the Vietnamese War was the way it had affected discipline in the Marine Corps, the character of the Marine Corps. That disturbed me, but not the war itself.
From the interviews that I've done, a lot of the men have complained, well, not necessarily complained, but have talked about how their religion has changed. Now, I understand you were on Monkey Mountain, which was considered a rocket-safe area.
That's right.
Right?
Very secure area.
Mm-hmm. Very secure. In a situation like that, your religion would not basically change. Am I correct?
Well, I don't think you're going to find anything very meaningful out of me about religion. I was raised in a family that had very strong religious feelings, and I was a very active churchgoer up to the age of 17 or 18 when I left home. And then my religion deteriorated along with my morals. And although I'm a strong believer in religious training for children, I am not a member of a church. I'm not active in any church. I hew to the basic tenets of Christianity, but I certainly am not, you know, active in a religious sense. And sitting on top of Monkey Mountain in the fog for 13 months, there certainly was no strain whatsoever on physical danger, you know.
If we put you in a hypothetical situation and say you were facing combat, do you think that would affect your religious views? Being shot at, like, all day?
Well, I don't know. It's the last time I got shot at in anger was in Korea in 1952. And I certainly, my views then, I don't think were much different than they are right now.
Earlier you mentioned that you knew while in Vietnam there was a lot of tension about the war here in the States. Did you discuss this with other officers or other men that you knew on Monkey Mountain?
One of our favorite topics of conversation is what the nuts back in the States were doing. You know, the papers were full of it, and of course, it was very heavily propagandized in the military newspapers. The military was considerably upset, still is, about the lack of support by some segments of the American public, you know, for the war. And the really strong anti-military movement that really got tremendous impetus out of the Vietnamese War. And of course, you know, that's well, professionals look at that as a direct threat. They still do. So it was one of our favorite topics of conversation.
So then it was very often discussed.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, what about Kent State and, let's say, the burning of Bank America? Now, I know that was in the Stars and Stripes. How did that affect the men over there?
Well, I had ambivalent feelings about this Kent State affair. I was horrified at the thought of kids getting shot on a campus. That just was absolutely unbelievable. No matter what the provocation, and I was contemptuous of the National Guard, as any professional military man is. The National Guard is a bag of worms, always has been, always will be. Military, speaking in the military sense, they're hardly any better trained than the rabble that they're supposed to be controlling in these riots, supposed riot control situations like Kent State. And yet, on the other side of the coin, I certainly had no sympathy at that time, absolutely no sympathy whatsoever, with the aims of the rioting students. Now, I think I was sensitive enough to the free speech issue. Even at that time, I was certainly sensitive enough then to feel that these kids had a right to assemble. They had a right to let their grievances be known. I wasn't sympathetic with a rock throwing bit, you know, that kind of thing.
It's hard to be.
But I was absolutely horrified, and most of my, I think almost without exception, my associates felt the same thing. But, you know, killing kids on a campus. Unarmed kids, whose only weapon is to throw a rock. You know, they're just absolutely no excuse whatsoever.
Well, do you think that these sort of riots on the campuses added tension in Vietnam?
Oh, undoubtedly, undoubtedly. They focused this the really strange feelings that we had to be in a foreign country, in a war situation, and to realize that there was such fantastic turmoil back here in the States over this war, the lack of support, it really gives a military man a very strange feeling to have the feeling that what you're doing perhaps has some illegitimacy about it.
In other words, you felt pretty left alone.
Well, I wouldn't use that term, left alone. Because we also had, you know, good old Barry Goldwater
and
and all the hawks in Congress and a great segment of the American population. You know, the hard hat marches in Washington, D.C. and all that kind of business. And we tended to identify with that segment of the population. You know, they support us. They think what we're doing here is right.
Do you feel like the American public really didn't understand the issues in Vietnam?
Well, that's a very, you know, I don't know. I'd have to make a very broad determination of that. I think that, I don't know if I can project my thinking back then, because my thinking has changed so radically since then. But I suppose probably at that time I thought that the Barry Goldwaters and the Strom Thurmonds and the military people, the supporters of the military, were the right thinkers, and the radicals were the wrong thinkers. Well, I've changed 180 degrees on that thinking. now. But then I'm pretty sure that I felt that the radicals certainly had a right to voice their dissent, but that their dissent was based on erroneous information. I supported the war. I really did.
Racial tensions were supposed to be a severe problem in Vietnam. Can you tell me a little bit about the black versus white confrontation, or just minority group problems?
Yes, we had a great deal of problems, even in the unit, the unit that I was in, where we really didn't have any pressure on us in a combat sense. And of course, Marines pride themselves on their discipline, and I think we had a fairly well-disciplined organization. It was a typical Marine organization. We had good control. But we did have a lot of tension between the blacks and the whites. The kind of tension I had never seen before in any Marine organization I'd been in.
What do you think made it more tense?
Well, of course, blacks had become a lot more active. The black movement had become a lot more active. And blacks in the service, in uniform, became more militant about the civil rights issue, about the black movement, just as they did in civilian. It carried from the civilian into the military. Most of the blacks, the majority of the blacks we had in our organization were young. We had one black officer during my tour there, a young flyer. And black officers are still a real curiosity in the Marine Corps. There just are not very many of them. There are a lot of black enlisted Marines. The majority of them are one or two termers, do maybe 3-4 years and out. There are not too many professionals.
Why do you think there aren't very many professionals?
Well, in the first place, historically, we didn't have black Marines until 1943. First black Marine ever, in 1943. And blacks were not encouraged in a professional sense until, I would say, probably in the early 60s. I know one black Marine very well, Sergeant Major Sam Huff. And Sam was probably one of the senior Master Sergeant of the Marine Corps when he was promoted to Sergeant Major. He had been eminently qualified for promotion for years. He'd been in the Marine Corps for almost 25 years and had been a Master Sergeant for 9 or 10. But the Marine Corps simply could not bring itself, the hierarchy couldn't bring itself to promote him to Sergeant Major. It was, I think, a kind of an unthinkable. And the civil rights push that started in the late 50s and late 60s slopped over into the military, and as a result, there were a lot more promotions into the senior enlisted ranks.
Did you find that most minorities stuck together, like into groups?
Well, there's only one minority in the Marine Corps, and that's the blacks. And that's because of the color differentiation. You can't identify a Jew, you can't identify name me some minorities.
A Chicano.
A Chicano. Well, you can usually identify a Chicano, but there are not many Chicanos in the Marine Corps. I don't know why that is, but there are not.
What about Orientals?
Very few. There are a few Samoans, and they're treated differently than the Orientals. Samoans have traditionally been kind of they're like the Filipinos in the Navy. They're kind of looked on as the pet gook.
Can you tell me?
I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. One of my best friends is a guy by the name of Yoyono Afualo. I've known him for years and years, and he's just a marvelous guy. But he's different. He's a Samoan. You know, Samoans are like nobody else in this world.
I know what you mean by the Navy having pets of the Filipinos.
Yeah, Filipinos are traditionally the stewards in the Navy. They run the mm-hmm. to run the officer's wardroom. And that's kind of the way the Marine Corps has looked at Samoans. They're just great to have around.
You said that there was a lot of racial tension on Monkey Mountain in that safe area. Well, do you think the tension was greater or less in combat areas?
Less.
How do you explain
that? Well, there's a cohesiveness between between guys, in the same fire squad, in the same fire team, in the same squad, or in the same platoon. When you're under fire, you depend on that guy next to you. You don't give a damn what color he is. In fact, there's some very close relationships between blacks and whites under those circumstances. Now, when you take a unit out of that situation and move back to the rear area, where there is a racial tension all the time, where you don't have that camaraderie due to the danger, then you'll find a difference in the relationship. Blacks in Vietnam really were very clannish. They tended to hang together. And, of course, the whites... I'm sure to a black it seems that the whites are clannish because, you know, when you look around you and you see nothing but white faces, any group tends to be a clan. And whites, of course, when they see more than two blacks together, you know, look at that. See,
that's a clan, too.
That's a clan. They're being stick-togetherness business, you know, very suspicious. I think that's kind of built into a white person in America. Your training is kind of pushed that way.
Do you mean we're trained to go into clans or to see clans?
No. To see clans, especially in minorities. When you see when you see four or five Chicanos together speaking Spanish and laughing, and there is a feeling of, there's that feeling as if... I don't know. Insecurity.
Yeah, I was going to say insecurity.
There's a feeling of insecurity, and you feel that way about blacks, and it's kind of built into us as white Americans. It's part of our racist background, our heritage, I guess. It's part of the training that we get. It's what we learn at school. We simply feel that way about blacks or Chicanos or, I guess we'd feel that way about Italian kids. Or Chinese kids in San Francisco, if they gather together in the street corner or out in the schoolyard and they're speaking Chinese, you're excluded.
You feel alienated.
Yes, and it's a very unusual position for a white American to feel in our white society, to feel alienated. And there's that feeling of threat. And I felt that in Vietnam. And of course the blacks are very much aware of this and they use it as a weapon. Now, that's
Was it an effective weapon?
Not very effective.
Thought it would
well,
be.
I don't know. I think it turns around on the blacks. But it is a weapon, and of course, in the situation they're in, they're prone to use any weapon they have, whether it's... I don't think they really have ever assessed that, the effect that has on whites. Very threatening.
What steps did the Marine Corps take to lessen this racial tension?
Oh, there was an awful lot of stuff published. Official stuff published about racial tension, about commanding officers. We formed committees, sensitivity committees, and racial. I can't remember the military terms now. There were certain terms that were used for these committees. I was a member of one, Monkey Mountain, composed of half whites and half blacks, and we had. I think we had the duty Samoan on it at one time, and a Chinese kid.
How effective were these groups?
Very ineffective.
Why is that?
Well, primarily because I really don't think the blacks wanted to communicate.
Did the whites try?
Yeah, I know. I was very sincere, I became quite sensitive to the problem. And I was... really eager to find a solution because tensions of that sort are so destructive to discipline in an organization. You know, when you polarize the troops and you have blacks staring at whites in the mess hall, at the clubs, at work, They get clannish in the barracks. They tend to group together. It's just bad, you know. There's an undercurrent of incipient violence, and it frightens people, and it's very destructive discipline. So I know that all the officers that we had were interested in trying to either push it under the rug or get rid of it or do something about it. But most of the blacks, I really think, most of the black kind of enjoyed the situation. It was I think a lot of them found themselves in a position where they had some power, where they were really affecting somebody. You know, Whitey was looking and listening.
And sweating.
And it must have been a heady feeling. You know, I'm very sympathetic toward what they must have felt. I felt threatened by it, but I understood it, I think, as much as a white could understand.
Drugs were also counted as one of the number one problems in Vietnam. Would you say that the prevalence of drug use was extremely high?
Yes. Now, my drug experience, we have drug problems on Monkey Mountain, but because of the fact that we were so isolated, it was 13 miles by road down into Da Nang. Line of sight, we were looking right directly at it. It's probably maybe 2,500 meters. But to get down to that town, it was really torturous. And we had very few Vietnamese civilians within our cantonment. So that the stuff that was moved into our site usually came in by the young Marines, brought it in. There was a regular drug run. And there was an awful lot of really high-quality marijuana. Some of the moon drops and that junk that you could buy in drugstores there, uppers and downers and all that kind of business. I don't think there was too much of the hard stuff.
You mean like heroin?
Yeah, I cocaine and that kind of business. It was primarily marijuana. But now down in the city, and outside the city, out in the villages, it was shoot the moon. Anything you wanted, you could get. Any opium derivative, all that drugstore junk.
Do you think that most of the men that were using drugs had used them before they came to Vietnam?
No, I really don't think so. I think the fact that it was so available, and it was so cheap, and it was the thing to do. It, you know, using drugs is really a marvelous way to thumb your nose at authority. It's so far outside the regulations, and yet it's not easy to detect. A guy can get high on marijuana, and unless he falls down and goes to sleep, it's really not too easy to detect. And I think that kind of tickled the imagination of some of those youngsters. It was a way of turning on, it was a way of thumbing your nose at the old man.
It's almost like when you were in, first and second grade, you used to try and chew gum in class without getting caught.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought, you know, there's some of that. Plus, it's the popular thing to do. It's the sophisticated thing to do.
Well, did you find this drug use not only among enlisted men, but officers?
Well, we suspected. Now, you must realize, as an enlisted man, I was really not in a position to know a hell of a lot about what was going on in the BOQ. We had a couple of young officers busted for marijuana use.
I mean
busted. Boy, they busted them hard. They were moved out of the organization, and as far as I know, I think they were both returned back to the States, and they were probably cashiered. Because that just absolutely was not condoned in commission officers.
So officers were busted. What about enlisted men?
Well, it was so prevalent, and it was so hard to control. It got to the point that in my organization, people tended to just look the other way. A lot of people were running scared about it, too. We had several fragging incidents, and it was directly related to drug searches. We'd have a drug search, a shakedown, and immediately following. Automatic. We knew we were going to have a fragging. So people were running scared.
Were there any other reactions to, like, soldiers being caught stoned, like, on guard duty, or in, with specific jobs they were found to be on drugs?
Let's use the term Marines.
Marines.
Yeah, we knew that there was an awful lot of smoking going on out in the bunkers. And in our periodic shakedowns, we almost always found stuff in the bunkers, hidden in the sandbags. Some of it, I'm sure, was deliberately put there, you know, like salt in the mine. The youngster's way of saying, look, I'm smoking, you know I'm smoking, and there's a damn thing you can do about it.
Kind of hard to catch them.
Right. You know, twisting the bear's tail.
Alcohol has always been a problem in the military. Was it cheaper in Vietnam?
Oh, of course. Practically give it away.
Did that have a tendency to lead people to drink more?
Well, there was an awful lot of boozing, as there is always in the military. You know, alcohol really is a problem. Alcoholism is a problem that's been around for years. It's not much discussed. Just recently has this really been brought out in the open and looked at by the military. And one of the first things they do in a place like Monkey Mountain up in a cantonment, first concern is to build a club, get the booze up there, and keep the troops happy with their beer. And there's that interminable discussion about whether you should give hard stuff to the sergeants or whether you should combine to the staff NCOs and so on and so forth. Oh, we had a lot of booze up there.
What type of regulations were put on alcohol?
Well, the troopers couldn't get hard stuff unless they were 18 or over, legally. And, of course, the hours were, the hours that the stuff was on sale was controlled. Couldn't have it in the barracks. You know, these are the kind of regulations that had in the military, the United States Marine Corps, ever since its inception, and they're the universally violated regulations, and the universe... personally, almost impossible to enforce regulations, but it, on the surface, you know, it's all very legal, and it looks good on the surface.
I interviewed one sergeant that was an E5, and he said his main complaint was that he wasn't able to buy packaged liquor, but that in any other service, enlisted men were allowed to buy packaged booze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he found this to be a real morale problem among him and his friends. Did you find that prevalent?
Well, where was this youngster?
I think he was, I'm not sure, Da Nang? He was pretty close by to Monkey Mountain at times.
Oh, really? Well, I can't imagine that he couldn't get a hold of booze.
Oh, well, he often got it.
Oh, sure. He just wanted to be able to do it legally.
He wanted to be able to buy it himself.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, booze in the service, the use of alcohol and the way it's handled, and the way it's dispensed, and who it's sold to, is a prerogative of the commanding officer. You can go from base to base and find different regulations, just like uniforms. It's kind of a local prerogative that's reserved for the commanding officer. And as long as the CO stays within the law, you know, it's against the law, federal law, to dispense alcohol to somebody who's under, say, 18 years old. But whether or not he wants package sales available to all ranks, or if he wants to restrict package sales to, say, E5 or E6 and above, or only to chief petty officers, or only to commissioned officers, that's his prerogative. You know? And it has to do with his own personal prejudices, or his idea of military discipline, or his own self-image, or whatever turns him on or off.
So then it could vary just about wherever you went.
Oh, yeah. Sure, this young guy might not have been able to get it, what was he, in the Navy?
Marine Corps.
In the Marine Corps, yeah. Well, I'm sure if he'd if he'd gone down to one of the CB bases, he could have gone in the enlisted club there and rubbed elbows with seamen and CPOs at the same bar. No problems. Yeah. Gone in as a guest and gotten all the booze he wanted. And I'm sure he did. You know, if he was a boozer, no problem getting out.
When you were talking about drugs, you mentioned fragging. Could you explain that term more fully?
Fragging is a term that relates to a type of grenade, a fragmentation grenade, and that's where the nickname comes from. So to frag somebody is to throw a fragmentation grenade at them. And the term fragging, as it was used in Vietnam, means simply it's a clandestine operation. It has nothing to do with throwing a grenade at a Vietnamese. It has to do with throwing a grenade at one of your own staff non-commissioned officers, an officer, usually an officer, or maybe a personal enemy. And the standard fragging technique was always done at night. It's always done anonymously. There's nothing more anonymous than a hand grenade. Absolutely nothing, because it's a self-destructing weapon. When it goes, the evidence goes. There's no such thing as getting fingerprints, or there's no way to identify, unless you're caught red-handed throwing the thing. There's just no way of knowing. And it's a small, you know, it weighs about a pound and a quarter. If you can throw a baseball, you can throw a frag grenade. No problem throwing. 40, 50 yards.
It was easy to conceal.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did you ever have any personal fear of fragging?
Certainly did. I think any NCO or officer was concerned about fragging. I had several threats.
Do you know what brought about these threats?
A normal military discipline. Now, this is nothing new. Junior troopers have always been angry at having to do menial tasks, or you know, there's the child parent relationship between the junior enlisted man, the senior enlisted man, the old military bugaboo, the sergeant, you know, the mean guy, or the bad officer, the guy with all the privilege, and there you are, you know, in the mud, and he's up there sleeping in sheets. There's all that normal resentment. That's always been around. But fragging is, I think, grew directly out of all this violence in our society that's been coming on in the last 10 or 15 years.
Was fragging always evident? Like you said, you were in the Korean War and in the World War. Was it evident then also?
There were some incidents of fragging. It wasn't called fragging then. I can't remember what the term was, but I remember there was the famous incident at the 2nd Marine Division camp at Camp Kamuela on the Big Island. Somebody booby trapped a head, 10 or 12 hole, or I can't remember what, and blew some poor guy away. You know, he went out there and looked it up. This is one of those sanitary 12 hole heads or 10 hole heads. He lifted up the sanitary seat, and there was a grenade that was attached to the lid, and the grenade was sitting in a 5 gallon can, a 5 gallon can of gasoline, and you know, it just blew him in the head. But that's told as that's a kind of a funny story. You know, when you really think of it, here's this guy going in there to do his bodily functions, and he gets his ass blown away. I've heard some people tell this story. It can really be funny if it's told right. Wasn't very funny to that guy that went in the head, but that was isolated stuff. Fragging in Vietnam was just part of that war.
Would you say one service had it worse than another?
Oh, I think the Army had real problems, much more so than the Marine Corps, and I doubt if the Navy had serious problems at all.
Why do you think the Army had it the worst?
Well, it's the nature of the organization. Army discipline tends to be comparatively poor compared to the Marine Corps. And the Army just does not have a professional attitude. Their junior enlisted troops simply don't get the kind of training that the Marine Corps does. They don't have a feeling of I just think it's the nature of the Army that they're going to have, they have more disciplinary problems of that nature.
Do you think that fragging was related to the drug problem in any way?
Oh, yeah, I think they're directly related.
How is that?
Well, the drug problem is a... drug use is a symptom of this militant attitude that's come on here in the last few years, in the last 10 years, I'd say. You know, the drug culture and the militancy kind of marched hand in hand. And with the militancy, you have violence, and fragging is just the epitome of that violence manifesting itself. So I just think they're inescapably linked. I think drugs and militancy and violence all coalesced in Vietnam, in the military situation, into this fragging business.
Well, you mentioned fragging and drugs in relationship to the deterioration of discipline, and you considered that a severe problem once before. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the fragging and the use of drugs are just, of course, they're the worst examples of the discipline problem. But I think the youngsters, when I talk about discipline, the changing discipline picture in the Marine Corps in the Vietnamese War, I think the youngsters that were coming into the Marine Corps, whether they were draftees or enlistees, well, they were a reflection of the attitudes of their generation. They brought these attitudes into the service with them. And although the Marine Corps prides itself on its training techniques in boot camp of remolding the man, you know, making a man out of the boy, make a Marine out of this, you know, this junk that they get for raw material. I just think that those attitudes carry over, and they carried over beyond boot camp. Whether our training system broke down or whether these attitudes were just too damn strong for normal training techniques, I don't think maybe it was that the Marine Corps simply didn't adjust itself properly to what is really a threat to military discipline. These kind of attitudes are a direct threat. You know, contempt of authority, and the fear that fragging engendered in leaders. You know, when my God, when you don't know if somebody's going to throw a damn hand grenade under your hooch and blow your ass away, it changes your attitude. It's inescapable. I've always prided myself on being a damn good Marine, and pretty tough, pretty rough and tough. I can take care of myself. You know, I'm big, and I've never been afraid to be physical. But it was almost impossible to take a normal attitude toward the troopers, the young Marines that I had a direct responsibility for you know, as a leader. My attitude changed toward them. I felt a fear. I tried to operate as if it weren't there, but it was there. I never went to bed. I never crawled in the rack at night in Vietnam without that running through my mind. And I incidentally always kept an M16 rifle. Just as a matter of course, I had an M16 rifle laying on a chair right next to my rack, and I always had a couple bandoliers of ammunition handy, just in case. And I never needed it; it never happened. I think my troopers were aware of the fact that was there. You know, as troopers are always aware of everything that goes on with their, you know, the junior troops are so tuned in. They really focus on the boss, on the guy they're working for. So I'm sure they were aware of this. I'm not saying that this was any kind of a deterrent. If somebody wanted to blow my ass away, they'd have done it. No. But it was my way of exhibiting that, okay, you know, here I am. You're coming, friend. You know, we'll meet each other eyeball to eyeball.
We're badass.